Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Chills at Will podcast. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode, and I'm glad to have you here for a fun episode. Hey, no joke, they're all fun. This has been a great quarantine distraction for me, and I hope for you as well. Episode 7 deals with dynamic O. Henry endings. Now, an obvious disclaimer that I'll make around today's show is that there are going to be spoilers galore. The particularly cool and subtle and heavy way that these endings land is something that you'll have to think about. Would you like to hear them secondhand or experience them for yourself? Today might be a day that you give these stories a reading before you listen to this episode. You will get a great experience out of it whether you read the stories or not, I hope. And at the very least, maybe you just read the stories and don't even listen to my podcast. No, I'm just kidding. Please listen to my podcast. But now might be a good time to pause this episode and read the short stories. The first is a short called A Day's Wade by Ernest Hemingway. There's the medium length The Gospel According to Mark by Jorge Luis Borges. And there's the slightly longer The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. If you're not familiar with O. Henry endings, they're derived from the writer William Sidney Porter, whose pen name was, you guessed it, O. Henry. O. Henry's stories frequently have surprise endings. And in his day, he was called the American answer to Guy de Maupassant. Guy de Maupassant, the French author. Hope my pronunciation was passable. While both authors wrote plot twist endings, O. Henry's stories were considerably more playful and are also known for their witty narration. Maybe the most famous of his writing, most famous of his O. Henry endings, the one with the surprise ending is The Gift of the Magi, which is about a young couple who are short on money but who so desperately want to buy each other Christmas gifts. In the story, Jim is unaware that Della has sold her beautiful hair, which happens to be her most valuable possession, so that she can buy a platinum fob chain for his watch. Unbeknownst to Della, Jim sells his watch, his own most valuable possession, to buy jeweled combs for Della's hair. The story features a high level of comic irony. The premise of the story has been copied, adapted, parodied, and in various ways retold in the centuries since it was written. Remember the biblical Ecclesiastes and Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls, who remind us that there is nothing new under the sun. That will come up again, particularly when we discuss the Gospel According to Mark, this idea of shared stories throughout humanity. Another plot twist for you, though this was in the middle, not the end, of the writer's life himself. He was actually a fugitive from the law who escaped the U.S. for Honduras after either being charged with embezzlement. He was charged with embezzlement. The question is, you know, whether or not he did it or not. This bank in Houston where he worked charged him with his embezzlement, and he was on the run for a while going on to Honduras. On the lam, as they might say in The Sopranos. Another writer with a, shall we say, checkered or lively past is Ernest Hemingway, the first writer to get a second shout out on this podcast. He was featured earlier on an earlier episode with his story, Old Man at the Bridge. I believe that was episode 3. His story, A Day's Wait, is one that I've always found a place for in my classroom, whether as part of a gender roles unit, a focus on diction and subtlety, being that the last 2 or 3 sentences of the story are ripe examples of this subtlety, or even as an easily accessible instance of dramatic irony. You might say, rightly so, that the dramatic irony in the story and Jackson's and Borges as well are not textbook examples of dramatic irony, as most readers, I would assume, do not understand what will happen at the end of the stories until it happens at the end of the story. The key, though, why I kind of put an asterisk next to this dramatic irony to denote these 3 stories, is that the second read-through is so crucial. And while you might be saying, well, duh, most if not all stories will take on dramatic irony upon a second reading. Yeah, of course. But I'm hoping to convince you by the end of this episode that these three particular stories are optimal for rereading, as their endings are so explosive and shocking and thrilling that you'll want to read them multiple times, and that your second and future readings will be so different than your first. Hemingway's story, A Day's Wait, uses an unnamed narrator, the father of nine-year-old Shots, to describe a day, or approximately a 9-to-5, in which Shots wakes up with a fever and the usual symptoms of influenza, which is diagnosed by a home-visiting doctor. Shots is pale, shivering, and he has dark areas under his eyes. As the day goes on, he zones out when his father reads to him. He resists his father's assurances that the sickness is nothing to worry about, and he lets slip cryptic comments like, "You don't have to stay in here with me, Papa, if it bothers you," and "Just the same so far," in response to a question about how he's feeling. His father, thinking that Shots is a little loopy from the fever and medication, goes out to give his son a little space. By the way, the name Shots, spelled S-C-H-A-T-Z, the name in German means treasure. Okay. This story was so well loved and is so well known that even Little John wrote a song about it. Ooh, that was cringy. That was actually kind of a good joke. Did anybody get that joke? So Shots, again, is, you know, really kind of freaking out. He's a little bit loopy from the fever and medication. At least that's what his father thinks. Does the father go out to do the laundry to give his son a break? Does he go study the day's newspaper? Does he go sort through his record collection? If records were a big time thing at the time. Possibly because this story takes place before the proliferation of records. You might want to call the anachronism police on me. But also, he doesn't do any of these three things because Hemingway, that most gritty and masculine of writers, has his narrator go to hunt. After a curiously forensic accounting of the quail that he missed and killed, the father comes back to an even more frozen up and fairly laconic boy who only lets forth that he, quote, "can't keep from worrying," end quote, and wonders if taking his medication will do any good. It is only when the father reads to his son from Howard Pyle's Book of Pirates, which is a sufficiently masculinity-infused children's book, that Shots, whose father describes him as, quote, "evidently holding tight onto himself about something," it is only then that Shots asks the million-dollar question which has been plaguing him all day and which inspires the story's title. I'll pick up the reading from there and follow through to the dynamic O. Henry ending. And this starts with the father narrating, quote, "I sat down and opened the pirate book and commenced to read, but I could see he was not following, so I stopped. About what time do you think I'm going to die?" Shots asked. "What? About how long will it be before I die?" "You aren't going to die. What's the matter with you?" "Oh, yes, I am. I heard him say 102. "People don't die with a fever of 102. That's a silly way to talk." "I know they do. At school in France, the boys told me you can't live with 44 degrees. I've got 102. He had been waiting to die all day, ever since 9 o'clock in the morning. "You poor Shots," I said. "Poor old Shots, it's like miles and kilometers. You aren't going to die. That's a different thermometer. On that thermometer, 37 is normal. On this kind, it's 98. "Are you sure?" "Absolutely," I said. "It's like miles and kilometers, you know. Like how many kilometers we make when we do 70 miles in the car." "Oh," he said. But his gaze at the foot of the bed relaxed slowly. The hold over himself relaxed too, finally. And the next day it was very slack, and he cried very easily at little things of no importance. End quote. This poor kid. Shots during the whole day was quietly suffering, ruminating on his impending death. Let's make this clear. Shots didn't think he was going to die. He knew he was going to die. Think of yourself as a kid, a 9-year-old like Shots, and there, everything in your life was an absolute. Subtlety and nuance weren't things we understood well, to put it lightly. I'll always remember my beloved first grade teacher sitting us down, my classmates and I, and we all laid out our lunches. She showed us how to eat our lunch in the proper order. Your sandwich or your Lunchables or your main dish was first, followed by your fruit, your applesauce, I guess that's a fruit, and then your crackers, your chips, and or your dessert. For many years, I shrugged at and wondered about those poor people who ate their chips first or their cookies before their quesadilla. Hadn't they learned the way? The one and only right way to eat lunch? When your parents or teachers or friends, people you liked and respected, told you something when you were a 9-year-old, there was often so little external thought. So when Shots was told by his classmates in France that a 44-degree fever was deadly, and his doctor on the same day says that his temperature was 102, you can imagine the mental and emotional fireworks going on in the poor kid's head. Not only was he going to die, he must have been thinking, he was going to die. With his temperature being more than 2 times the fatal rate. And therein lies the power and chill that comes from the narrator's line. He had been waiting to die all day, ever since 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm not going to front here. The first time I read this story, I did not see this plot twist coming. Hemingway so skillfully, quietly, and slowly builds the tension such that even the father is blindsided by his son's miscalculation. Hemingway, often criticized for having weak female characters in his fiction, if any female characters at all, builds a character who has already learned at such a young age what it is to be a man in society. A man is stoic, emotionally tough, is a take on any burdens by himself. This boy, born into a world where men hunt and boys read stories of pirates, knows subconsciously that he is not to show weakness or fear, even in the face of certain death. This boy, this 9-year-old, is way more male than he is young. The idea of him thinking that he has to keep this absolute torment and existential pain to himself is one of the saddest things that someone can read. What a critique of the dangers of masculine archetypes by the writer so closely identified with living as a masculine archetype and creating them in his writing. And yes, though the literal ending of the story, the last 3 sentences, may not set off any metal detectors and aren't in themselves the O. Henry ending, these last 3 sentences are of their own merit so powerful. This boy, waiting to die all day, is finally convinced by his dad that he's not going to die, that he simply misunderstood Celsius versus Fahrenheit, and does he shout for joy? Does he hug and kiss his dad like Marge Simpson smothering her little boy Barty after he repents of his previous shoplifting and spends his own money on a beautiful family photo for a Christmas gift? Does he cry into his dad's shirt? Does he howl that he's so glad to be alive? No. He simply says, "Oh." The masculine front has not yet worn off. But the last paragraph, seemingly innocuous, says so much. As this boy who so valiantly thought he was relieving his father of a burden becomes a boy again, a child. Quote, "But his gaze at the foot of the bed relaxed slowly. The hold over himself relaxed too, finally. And the next day was very slack, and he cried very easily at little things of no importance." The second story for this O. Henry-themed episode is Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. An innovative co-worker joined my high school staff this year with a nice injection of new, relatively speaking, literature and ideas. And one story that our 10th grade students read early in the year was Jackson's The Lottery. I kept talking to her as if I knew all about it because I thought I did. You know, it's the story where the kid keeps riding and coaxing the heck out of his toy horse, eventually dying due to his fervor in getting the rocking horse to correctly predict the winners of the horse races. Those horse races which have made his money-hungry mom finally have a good amount of money? Ooh, that was definitely wrong. Yeah, that's D.H. Lawrence's The Rocking Horse winner. And I was for some reason totally assured that this was the lottery story that my coworker talked about. Imagine my double surprise when I read the story for the first time, a day or two before my students would be reading it. Oh, this isn't the story I was picturing. This story, like Hemingway's A Day's Wait, lends itself so easily to a second and third reading. And those future readings are so pleasurable in their own ways, as every finely placed detail, every subtlety, every clue registers differently. To be able to read a story, the same story, twice and get a totally different but equally satisfying experience, that is the visceral beauty of literature. So what do you get on your first reading of Jackson's The Lottery? You get an innocuous story of a village prepping for the annual lottery, which lasts one day in this hamlet of 300 people. The children get stones together, the boys bogarting the smoothest ones, their tones a bit hushed, and the men and women gather in small groups, quietly chatting, with Jackson describing them as smiling rather than laughing. The jovial and fairly relaxed Mr. Summers brings in the black box and assorted basic equipment for the lottery, getting a little help from the men close by. Most of the tradition of the lottery persists, some of it morphing in harmless ways, like paper being used now for people's names instead of the former wood chips. A perfunctory series of small steps, like marking down the names of the heads of families and singing a tuneless chant, are undertaken with workmanlike efficiency. A Mrs. Hutchinson draws quiet laughter as she comes running up, having almost forgotten the occasion of the annual lottery. After accounting for anyone who may be missing, and figuring out that this man who's missing, his wife will draw for him, this injured man, also accounting for old man Warner, present again at his ripe old age, the drawing of papers from the box begins with a sense of seriousness and duty, with the names being picked in alphabetical order. As the lottery gets into the last 8 or 9 letters of the alphabet, a couple old-timers talk contemptuously about the changes in society. And I quote, "They do say," Mr. Adams said to old man Warner, who stood next to him, "that over in the North Village they're talking of giving up the lottery." Old man Warner snorted. "Pack of crazy fools," he said. "Listening to the young folks, nothing's good enough for them. Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves, nobody work anymore, live that way for a while. Used to be a saying about lottery in June, corn be heavy soon. First thing you know, we'd all be eating stewed chickweed and acorns. There's always been a lottery," he added petulantly. "Bad enough to see young Joe Summers up there joking with everybody." "Some places have already quit lotteries," Mrs. Adams said. "Nothing but trouble in that," old man Warner said stoutly. "Pack of young fools." End quote. Even Mr. Summers is part of the lottery and takes a slip of paper. And old man Warner remarks that this is his own 77th year of the lottery. One of many, oh dang, moments that comes to fruition upon completion of the story with his O. Henry ending. With Warner finishing, Mr. Summers, as if he's a civil servant reading the minutes at a city council meeting, asks everyone to open up their slips of paper. Tessie Hutchinson, to the chagrin of her husband, points out what she says are irregularities in how everyone picked and angrily calls out the unfairness. Bill Hutchinson, the husband, quietly looks down at the winning paper, picked on behalf of his family, And I remember wondering the first time I read this why he wasn't happy about winning the lottery. Because Bill is the head of the family members of the Hutchinsons will individually redraw to see who wins. There's even a moment that on first read seems cute and thoughtful, but on second reading scars the heart. I quote, "Remember," Mr. Summers said, "take the slips and keep them folded until each person has taken one. Harry, you help little Dave." Mr. Graves took the hand of the little boy who came willingly with him up to the box. "Take a paper out of the box, Davy," Mr. Summers said. Davy put his hand into the box and laughed. "Take just one paper," Mr. Summers said. "Harry, you hold it for him." Mr. Graves took the child's hand and removed the folded paper from the tight fist and held it while little Dave stood next to him and looked up at him wonderingly. End quote. The family all draws, and the hushed crowd and hushed tones of Mr. Summers inform the reader that Tessie has the paper with the blackened pencil mark. The crowd stirs as Bill Hutchinson holds up his wife's paper. And the O. Henry ending, so slow and methodical in its construction, now explodes with frightening speed. Here is the story's breathless and breathtaking ending. Quote, "All right, folks," Mr. Summers said, "let's finish quickly." Although the villagers had forgotten the ritual and lost the original black box, they still remembered to use stones. The pile of stones the boys had made earlier was ready. There were stones on the ground with the blowing scraps of paper that had come out of the box. Mrs. Delacroix selected a stone so large she had to pick it up with both hands and turned to Mrs. Dunbar. "Come on," she said, "hurry up." Mrs. Dunbar had small stones in both hands, and she said, gasping for breath, "I can't run at all. You'll have to go ahead and I'll catch up with you." The children had stones already, and someone gave little Davy Hutchinson a few pebbles. Tessie Hutchinson was in the center of a cleared space by now, and she held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved in on her. "It isn't fair," she said. A stone hit her on the side of the head. Old Man Warner was saying, come on, everyone." Steve Adams was in the front of the crowd of villagers with Mrs. Graves beside him. "It isn't fair. It isn't right," Mrs. Hutchinson screamed. And then they were upon her. End quote. How do I put into words the overriding realization and miniature realizations that occurred upon my reading this ending? The image of someone giving Tessie's little son a few pebbles, the muted and unmuted remembrance of the boys at the beginning of the story gathering smooth stones, Mrs. Delacroix grabbing a stone so large that she needed two hands, and the utter loneliness of Tessie Hutchinson a few minutes before, who was a source of mild irritation for the reader, perhaps, and now she's about to be stoned to death. I present to you these five rapid-fire comments from emails that I sent within 4 minutes of each other after finishing the story for the first time. These were sent to the coworker who had shared this story with me. These are contemporaneous memos, if you will. "Poor little Davy Hutchinson. They were helping him unroll his lottery ticket." The second one, "It could have been him that got that lottery ticket." The third one, "Dang." Let it be known there were 5 A's in the word dang. The fourth short comment from the email, "Students brought up a good point." And my students did. "Old Man Warner is truly playing with fate. In 77 years, never having pulled the, quote, winning ticket." And the last of the email comments, "What a story." It was such a rush to read this brilliant critique of stubborn and arbitrary tradition and this earthquake of an ending. Our third chill-inducing O. Henry ending comes from the legend Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentine writer and inspiration of so many disciples. The gospel according to Mark is such a short yet full piece that it invites wonder and awe. The same wonder and awe with which protagonist Baltasar Espinosa is treated by the Gutre family. Espinosa is described as a sort of effete, but not mean-spirited bourgeois member of Argentina's educated middle class. I will let Borges' characterization of Espinosa speak for itself. I quote, "We may describe him for now as one of the common run of young men from Buenos Aires, with nothing more noteworthy about him than an almost unlimited kindness and a capacity for public speaking that had earned him several prizes at the English school in Ramos Mejia. He did not like arguing and preferred having his listener rather than himself in the right. Although he was fascinated by the probabilities of chance in any game he played, he was a bad player because it gave him no pleasure to win. His wide intelligence was undirected. At the age of 33, he still lacked credit for graduation by one course, the course to which he was most drawn. His father, who was a free thinker, like all the gentlemen of his day, had introduced him to the lessons of Herbert Spencer, but his mother, before leaving on a trip to Montevideo, once asked him to say the Lord's Prayer and make the sign of the cross every night. Through the years, he had never gone back on that promise. Espinosa was not lacking in spirit. One day, with more indifference than anger, he had exchanged two or three punches with a group of fellow students who were trying to force him to take part in a university demonstration. Owing to an acquiescent nature, he was full of opinions or habits of mind that were questionable. Argentina mattered less to him than a fear that in other parts of the world people might think of us as Indians. He worshipped France but despised the French. He thought little of Americans but approved the fact that there were tall buildings, like theirs, in Buenos Aires. He believed the gauchos of the plains to be better riders than those of hill or mountain country. When his cousin Daniel invited him to spend the summer months out at La Colorada, he said yes at once. Not because he was really fond of the country, but more out of his natural complacency and also because it was easier to say yes than to dream up reasons for saying no." End quote. What a skilled characterization right there. A lot of writers will tell you that you do need to have the tell, and there is some telling, but so much showing. I may have to double dip and use that when I do a future episode on characterization. Wow. When he gets back to his cousin's ranch, Espinosa meets the Gutre family. They're laborers and ranch hands of the estate, and Espinosa's cousin is soon caught out of town on business. The Gutres are later described as being descended from Brits. Their original family name was Guthrie. They were people who married indigenous people, and the family line eventually was an intermingling of indigenous and British. The family Bible that Espinosa finds broke off about 1870, when the family had lost the ability to write. So as far as, you know, continuing the family tree and the lineage, there had been a break. Borges describes the family history, quote, "After a few generations, they had forgotten English. Their Spanish, at the time Espinosa knew them, gave them trouble. They lacked any religious faith, but there survived in their blood, like faint tracks, the rigid fanaticism of the Calvinist and the superstitions of the Pampa Indian." Unquote. Espinosa enjoys the family's company and finds them quaint and admirable in their simplicity. Like some 21st century millennial who believes in, quote, "experiences, not things," Espinosa files away his corporal experiences with the Gutres, things like working the ranch and doing physical labor to minimize livestock and farm damage when a huge flood of biblical proportions strikes. All these corporal experiences he puts into his mental slideshow that he looks forward to sharing with his university friends upon his return to cosmopolitan Buenos Aires. Communication among the three Gutres, which is summed up by Borges as, quote, the father, an unusually uncouth son and a daughter of uncertain paternity, unquote, was difficult, as they are further described as barely articulate. In the awkwardness and openness of the post-dinner evening hours, Espinosa decides to read to them. And after starting off with some assorted medical and erotic novels, history books, and veterinary medicine chronicles, he moves on to the Bible, about which he is fairly ambivalent, but fairly educated. He has invited the family in from their off-the-house living quarters due to the flood. He grows a beard, he likes the bearing it gives him, and he notices the Gutre's intense reverence for him and that Bible with the golden letters on the cover. When he continues to read Mark's gospel nightly to them and is even able to use pills to treat an injury to the girl's pet lamb, their admiration and devotion grow, as evidenced by the complimentary words they use when they speak of him, thinking that he can't hear. After having finished Mark's gospel over various nights, he plans to move on to the other three. But Borges describes the family's adherence to pattern and ritual that makes them ask to hear the same gospel read again, nightly. As the storm and flood rage on, the girl one night enters Espinosa's room silently, and she loses her virginity to him. Espinosa makes up his mind to tell no one of this, even his friends back in Buenos Aires. As the day dawns, Espinosa is nervous that he's going to be called out by the father, but nothing is mentioned by anyone about the sexual encounter. And from here, I'll let the precious words of Borges finish out his story. Quote, the next day began like the previous ones, except that the father spoke to Espinosa and asked him if Christ had let himself be killed so as to save all other men on earth. Espinosa, who was a free thinker but who felt committed to what he had read to the Gutres, answered, yes, to save everyone from hell. Gutre then asked, what's hell? A place under the ground where souls burn and burn. And the Roman soldiers who hammered in the nails, were they saved too? Yes, said Espinosa, whose theology was rather dim. All along, he was afraid that the foreman might ask him about what had gone on the night before with his daughter. After lunch, they asked him to read the last chapters over again. Espinosa slept a long nap that afternoon. It was a light sleep, disturbed by persistent hammering and by vague premonitions. Toward evening, he got up and went out onto the gallery. He said, as if thinking out loud, the waters have dropped. It won't be long now. It won't be long now, Gutre repeated, like an echo. The three had been following him. Bowing their knees to the stone pavement, they asked his blessing. Then they mocked at him, spat on him, and shoved him toward the back part of the house. The girl wept. Espinosa understood what awaited him on the other side of the door. When they opened it, he saw a patch of sky. A bird sang out. A goldfinch, he thought. The shed was without a roof. They had pulled down the beams to make the cross. End quote. This ending, my gosh, this ending, what a visceral gut punch. I'm reminded of the involuntary profanity that escapes Ethan Hawke's lips and launches him out of his chair when Denzel's character from Training Day ends the seemingly jokey and jovial atmosphere by shooting drug dealer and supposed friend Roger. That Espinosa knows, perhaps right before or right after, we as the reader know that he is to be crucified by his adherents, is a stunner, one that makes you feel alive, though the text is so obviously dark. And that spark that comes out of admiration, the admiration comes from Borges so quietly and slowly laying the breadcrumbs, letting us know of the Guthrie's simplicity and ignorance in the truest sense of the word, and Espinosa's perhaps gilded intelligence, high on book smarts, and fairly low on the wisdom of hardcore living. The crying lover, the Guthrie girl, perhaps playing the role of Mary Magdalene, is quite a controversial statement on Borges' part. The acting out of the crucifixion scene from the mocking and spitting to its conclusion, yet another skillful part. This acting out of the scene from mocking to spitting to the conclusion of death on the cross. We have read a writer at the top of his game. The crucifixion scene harkens back to the reference made earlier in the story to Espinosa noting the Iliad and the gospel retelling of Jesus' passion and death on Golgotha as seemingly the main stories that mankind has leaned on and retold over centuries. Borges' O. Henry ending is so dynamic and beautifully executed, but he's not done yet. Even in writing his final word, he's not done. Do the Guthries think that this death will allow Espinosa to resurrect? That it will save them and save humanity? A shocking ending that titillates and still ruminates for both his questions and answers? Señor Borges, this is truly a mic drop. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please pass it on to somebody who you know will enjoy it. I'd love for you to leave comments and subscribe at the podcast hub, chillsatwillpodcast6.podbean.com. You can find me, Pete Real, on Facebook and Instagram at Chills at Will Podcast, all one word, and on Twitter at Chills at Will PO1. Drop me a line, comment on a post, take part in a poll I trot out. Whatever it is, I look forward to hearing from you. The music from today's episode was from Mark E. Bassey called Plot Twist. This is from his album Gossip Columns from Republic Records. And there's, of course, the music from the iconic Grease, the equally iconic song called You're the One I Want. Grease is from Paramount Pictures. Until next time, my hope is that you continue to find that writing that gives you chills at will.